Marijuana legalization is just the beginning of a process of restoring our natural rights to the cannabis plant. Join us now as we learn more about the rules, regulations, and court decisions that are shaping the landscape of legal marijuana in this edition of Pot Public Policy. Welcome back, everyone. In this edition of Pot Public Policy, we're taking a look at one aspect of the criminal justice system that can affect cannabis consumers who get popped with possession of marijuana, and that's the system of cash bail in America. This is a system that's been around since the early 1900s, where in order to guarantee that you're not going to run off on your charge of holding the bag, you got to pay a certain amount of cash to get out of jail. And unfortunately, if you're poor and can't afford that, you've got to stay in jail. There's an 11th Circuit court case coming up that may decide whether or not requiring poor people who can't afford it to pay bail is actually constitutional or not. And joining us to discuss this, we've got Jeffrey Clayton here from he's the policy director from the American Bail Coalition. And Jeffrey, welcome to the show. Thanks for being here.
Thanks, Russ, for having me on. I appreciate it.
Okay, so we've kind of set up the case here where the decision is whether or not requiring people who are really poor, who can't afford bail, whether or not they should have to stay in jail when someone who's rich can just get out of jail by giving a bail bondsman some money. And what is the position of your organization on this? And can you explain why you support that position?
Well, that's the theory of the plaintiffs who are advocating for the complete elimination of all monetary conditions of bail in the country right now. Our coalition is against that particular portion of the movement, even though, as you say, it's some of these low-level cases where, like possession of marijuana cases being a good example, that there should be some bail reform on that. But these particular activists are trying to throw out the entire system, which certainly would have huge implications for those charged with marijuana possession and distribution and all other crimes in the country.
When they talk about throwing out the entire system of cash bail, do they offer some sort of replacement?
Yeah, they're really highlighting the federal system and the District of Columbia system after which it was modeled as the example, which unfortunately uses what is called preventative detention, which is sort of a move against the American tradition that everybody has a right to bail, and locks people up with no bail. And so that was a good idea in 1983, but has increased the rate of detention in the federal system by 267%. And most of those were drug cases, let's just be frank about it, given the crack cocaine disparity and all the things going on in the 80s, that's who it hit. And so to then say we should eliminate the current system and then have states adopt that system, I think could have, you know, wide-ranging impacts on people.
There is that difference between the federal bail system and the state bail system. I found some, the 1966 Bail Reform Act during the Johnson administration, the idea here being under the federal system that they're not going to hold people who haven't been convicted if they're just too poor to pay bail. It's interesting, as I started looking up some of the facts on this that were kind of amazing to me, that there's between 500,000 and 750,000 people in jail at any given time who are just charged. They're innocent until proven guilty. So they're sitting in a cell, presumably innocent, but they were too poor to be able to afford the bail to get out. And housing these prisoners is costing us $9 billion a year in taxpayer costs. And 60 to 70% of the people that were housed in such a way never ended up being convicted. And that includes 115,000 people who were drug convictions. So as far as bail reform goes, you're arguing against throwing the whole system out. What would you suggest as far as reforms on this? Because here on the show, we've told numerous stories of people who get popped for some sort of low-level drug crime. They end up dying in jail, and just because they couldn't afford $100 for bail or whatever. What can we do?
Yeah, and, you know, I live in my home state of Colorado where, you know, the laws have been liberalized, and simple possession is, you know, not an arrestable crime. And so I think it's not just bail reform, it's the whole process of arrest. What are we arresting people? Why are we arresting certain people for certain crimes? Because if we're going to turn around and let people go after we arrest them, why are we arresting them in the first place? So I think that's the thing to look at is these low-level bails, and then also what the plaintiffs are asking for in that case, which is due process, because a judge makes the decision. They look at all the factors, and the person makes their argument as to what they can and can't pay, and a judge, you know, makes that decision. The other thing I'll point out is the vast majority of the reason people stay in pre-trial is due to other factors, like they have multiple pending cases or immigration holds or the like. So even though there is room for reform, it's not the majority of the problem.
Yeah. What other stuff I found on this was that the average stay in jail for these folks is about 21 days. And there was the terrible case of Khalif Browder in New York City, popped for supposedly stealing a backpack, ended up serving 3 years in Rikers because he couldn't make his bail. The 3 years kind of affected his mind, and after he got out of jail, he committed suicide. And again, this guy wasn't convicted of anything. He just couldn't afford to get out on bail.
The Khalif case, if I could just interrupt. The Khalif case actually highlights what I'm talking about, because he was on a probation hold.
Yeah.
So he wasn't bailable. And that's the unfortunate part. He may have been bailable for a period of hours, but the reality is he was going back in. Plus, he's a juvenile in solitary confinement.
Yeah.
But that, I think, illustrates my point, is that when we just look at money as being the number one problem, we're missing a lot of the other problems that are out there that we could fix.
Let's look on the other side of the bail issue. Folks that haven't been to jail may not know this, but when you get popped, I got popped in Utah, they assign a cash bail. Mine was $1,167 for having a tiny, tiny, tiny amount of cannabis oil. And then there's bail bondsmen. Bail bondsmen can then, you can pay them 10%. They'll put up the rest, and then you can get out of jail. But what we found is that there's four states here in America, and I'm in Oregon, which is one of the states that have eliminated for-profit bail bondsmen. Multnomah County, my home county here, is one of the ones that's done a lot of reform on bail, with more pretrial supervision, close street supervision, electronic ankle monitoring, and such. So is the profit motive part of the problem here? Because since 1990, there's been a 50% increase in how much the bond is, and a 50% increase on how many crimes are charged or given bail. Is the profit motive part of the problem?
You know, it could be. I don't see that as being the problem. I don't really note, in looking at the four states that have done the reforms, that the results are very much different. You look at the city of Chicago as a mess, because they're doing low $100 and $200 bonds. And so, you know, I think it's just about having a smart system more than it is we hate commercial bail, or, we like it. And so I think it's, you know, states' choices to do that. And I think the research certainly shows that cash bail works better than recognizance release with supervision. But, you know, in some places, in some cases, you know, supervision can be effective.
You know, this commercial bail industry in the United States pulls in $2 billion a year in revenue, and the U.S. and the Philippines are the only countries on earth that still have some sort of commercial for-profit bail system. Why are we the outliers? Why has the rest of the world abandoned this?
Well, I think it's just a matter of that they never adopted it, but they never adopted things like due process or having the judge and the prosecutor be two different people either.
But wait. You're telling me the United Kingdom doesn't have due process?
Oh, no. I'm talking, the United Kingdom has financial conditions of bail. They just don't have commercial
for-profit bail, right. Exactly. That's my point.
Right.
Is this for-profit bail commercial model is generating $2 billion worth of profit here in the United States. That suggests to me that it's going to have a lot of lobbying pressure on our legislators to maintain crimes and to increase crimes and increase amounts of bail to fund that profit motive.
It's certainly a possibility. I think, having been a person on the front lines who's on the side of keeping the industry, I would say that the opposition has substantially more resources than we do. That's why we're having a difficult time right now, you might say.
I guess maybe at the heart of it, aside from all the statistics and the anecdotes, is just the concept of the idea that if I'm a poor person, I have to stay in jail when I'm innocent. But if I'm a rich person, I don't have to stay in jail when I'm innocent. What about that basic concept? I mean, is it just morally wrong?
I don't think so, because a judge is making that decision, like I said, based typically on 15 factors, but that's a policy choice. And if that's the choice, then, folks need to be prepared for the outcome. And that's, the costly DC system, or sort of the risk that if we take away money as sort of a temporary means of detaining someone, with a possibility release, that we're replacing that with no possibility release. And so what would the system look like afterwards, I think, is more than just sort of fundamentally saying it's wrong.
Well, as I look at the statistics here, I find that African Americans are assigned higher bail amounts than white people for the same exact crime. So it seems to me the system itself is broken and needs some serious reform. But we are out of time at this part of the segment. I want to thank you, Jeffrey Clayton, for joining us. And before I let you go, to give out any sort of websites or information you might want to suggest for people that are interested in this topic.
Absolutely. Hit our website at AmericanBailCoalition.org and click the In the News section, and has updates on all things bail reform in this country. Thanks, Russ, for having me on. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Jeffrey. It's a complex subject, and I appreciate taking a deeper look at it. And we'll research it more, and maybe we'll get you back on for more discussion. Thanks a lot.
Fantastic. Thank you.
All right. That's all the time we got for Hour 1, but stay tuned for Toker Talk Radio Hour 2. We'll take your calls at 650-LEGAL-MJ. What do you think about the cash bail system? All I know is that when I was busted in Utah, I didn't have $1,100 to my name. In fact, if I didn't have some really good friends that got nice deep bank accounts, I might still be in Utah jail. We're also going to dissect more of the Stoners Against Legalization, that dragonfly De La Luz. She's doubled down on hijacking the good name of Seattle Hemp Fest, Vivian McPeak. We'll give you the details, plus tear apart some more of their talking points. For everyone here at CannabisRadio.com, I'm Radical Russ. Thanks for joining us. And until next time, take care of each other, tokers.
This is the Russ Belville Show. The Russ Belville Show is blogging and podcasting daily at RadicalRuss.com. You take a seed, you plant it, you grow it, you try it, you roll it, you smoke it. You take a seed, you plant it, you grow it, you try it, you roll it, you smoke it, and it goes down smooth.